EMSradio.com.
EMS information for the next generation.
The EMS Leadership Podcast is a production of EMSradio.com. You can interact with us via email, emsleadership@gmail.com, or call us 303-720-6001.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the EMS Leadership Podcast. And now here's your host, Chris Ceballero.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. You're right. You're not hearing things. We are back. It is time once again for the EMS Leadership Podcast. I am reminded that it's been close to a year since we've come and we've brought you a show, and it was time to get the band back together, and that's exactly what it was. I had to find my sunglasses. I had a half a pack of cigarettes. We had a full tank of gas, and we went on a road trip to get the band back together, and it's time once again to bring you great episodes of the EMS Leadership Podcast. I'm Chris Ceballero, everyone. I want to thank you for joining us. I want to thank you for being patient, but we're back, and we're getting ready to bring you some great content, and with me always is that great cast of characters, our good friend Don Lundy. Don, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Chris. Who were you talking about? Anyhow, it couldn't have been us, because we never left, did we?
That's right. We never broke up. We just went on a one-year vacation. That's what I'm going to say.
That's right.
People
That's
thought
right.
we broke up. Nope, we didn't break up. We just went on a one-year vacation. How are things going in South Carolina, Don? Good?
Good. Matthew came through, and he left, a little bit of wood. Anybody in the audience needs a little bit of wood or leaves? I have piles of it around the house, but otherwise there's no damage, and we're back to as much normal as we can be.
And we're going to take a trip to the north, and we're going to talk to the gentleman with the original Virginia accent, our international correspondent, Rob Lawrence. Rob, how are you?
I'm absolutely great, Chris. Thanks for reminding everybody that we never officially broke up, although you did say it was okay if we saw other people.
That's right, I did, and I do appreciate you not flaunting that in our face, and it made everything worthwhile. But Rob, how are things in Virginia? What's been going on with you over the past few months?
Well, firstly, sympathizing with Don, we watched that Matthew very, very closely. We were actually all both in EMS World Expo and watching the track of Matthew. From our perspective, it turned right at the right moment, and so we were spared. And of course, our thoughts go out to all those people that are still dealing with it. And even now, as Don said, the rains came and it's still flooding as it's coming downstream. So Virginia is sending a lot of people via the incident management teams to all states south of us to assist. And good luck to those guys. I know from our locality that are deployed down there. On the work front, we, like everybody else, I think, are enduring, and that's probably the appropriate word, the opioid epidemic. We are seeing some interesting mixtures in the concoctions that these people are taking. And we are forming lots of opioid work groups, both with police, with public officials. We even had the Virginia Attorney General run out with us a couple of weeks ago, really to get a handle on this. And perhaps this could be another show topic in the future, Chris.
Yeah, and I think it really needs to, Rob, because now we're talking about, you know, they're trying to make some strides, one, but two, now we're starting to see a bigger strain of opioids as they're mixed with elephant tranquilizer called carfentanil, and, you know, it's making that big play in the in Ohio and West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and we do need to keep an eye on that, but I do agree with you, Rob. It's something we need to talk about. But guys, I got to tell you, I'm really excited to be back with you, and you know, we had some time, and you know, I took a career change myself and started my own consulting service, and I've been kind of setting up community paramedicine programs around the United States. I've been doing some leadership development, and you know, the schedule didn't allow really to get back to a regular spot where we can just get together, get the boys back together, and kind of talk about leadership. But we're here. We're going to come try to bring you shows every couple weeks and try to keep that content live. So we appreciate the fans that are joining us again. And we're going to start off by talking about EMS 3.0. And, you know, we talk about community paramedicine and we talk about what the future of that is going to look like. And, you know, just to give you a little bit of background, when community paramedicine started and really kind of hit in about 2009, there were four community paramedicine programs. In 2014, there was about 180. And in 2016, there's about 280 now. And what's interesting is that no two programs are alike. And 2017 is certainly going to be a time frame that we're going to see community paramedicine really bust at the seams. And one of the reasons for that is more individuals in the healthcare industry are going to start to get penalties We were just talking before we started to record that in 2017, home health will now start to get penalized in 2017 for high-risk readmissions. And where home health may have been a adversary to community paramedicine, they are very quickly going to become an ally, because if you run primary 911 and you're taking these home health patients to the hospital and they're being readmitted, there's going to need to be some discussions there with those home health partners. So I think the first question I have for you guys is, you know, we've heard about community paramedicine for a long time. You know, Rob, Virginia has some challenges and hurdles they're looking to get over for their community paramedicine programs. I know you're getting ready to start. You guys are still active, very active nationally. So I think the first question that I want to ask and get your opinion on is, since we first started to discuss community paramedicine in 2009, how do you think the transition has helped or hurt the EMS career field? And Don, maybe I'll go to you first.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I want to point something out, because I think a lot of people get somewhat of the bad idea when we talk about 3.0, we talk about moving to that next step. And I think 3.0 was kind of picked. I think probably Matt had a lot to do with that, the guru of what the next EMS system is going to look like. And I think he felt that that would be better understood, that we're going to go to 3.0, than to tell people, hey, we're going to improve EMS, we're going to do a bunch of stuff. And I thought it was great. And while we will be talking about community paramedicine, and I know people have heard an awful lot about it, I just want to make sure that we cover the fact that there's a lot more to 3.0 than just that corner of the world. And when people shrug their shoulders and go, I don't need to listen to that, we're not going to have a community paramedic program, well, number one, you don't know that for a fact. So stand by to be boarded. And number two, there are things about 3.0 having to do with education and having to do with the entire transformation of emergency medical services and what it means for us. And if anybody in the audience says, well, you know, we're still going to run emergency calls, absolutely. But you ought to take a look around and you ought to look at the horizon to see how that has changed. We've had many people in the public service industry who have had their job duties reduced because of some great work that they've done. And I'll point out the firefighters who did a tremendous job of reducing fires in the home, of all sorts of educational issues and building issues and construction issues. Several bombs that were set up with LP gas tanks did not explode the way the bad guys wanted them to, mostly because of firefighters who developed that valve. So when you look at the work that they've done, it's been tremendous. Well, that's happening in EMS as well. And if we can't position ourselves, and that's where community paramedicine comes in, but it's more than that. If we can't position ourselves to be ready for the next step, are you gonna go to emergency calls? Yes. Are emergency calls being reduced? Well, my bet is the whole audience would say, no, we're just busier than ever. Well, you know, the scary thing about data is pretty good at data, and you shouldn't ask the question in data unless you want the answers. And if you pull national data, you're going to know that shortness of breath, through a series of good things that we in the medical community have done, has been reduced. The amount of shortness of breath patients you go on, the amount of CVAs that you go on has been reduced. The amount of heart attacks has been reduced. That's never going to go away, that's true, but there's an entire pocket of patients out there that need to be touched by community paramedicine. So I just want to preempt our conversation with that. The best thing that's happened with community paramedicine in our community is it has made us start to think outside the box as to how we can touch patients in a better way, a more broader way, to look at the whole horizon of healthcare issues and see if we can preempt any of that. You know, we've done it for years in public education and rolled our eyes and said it's not enough. Well, this certainly not only does that, but it puts us into the healthcare entity. Unlike being the technicians who use the truck and take us to the hospital, there's a big difference between being healthcare providers and the technician that puts us on a bed and takes us to the hospital. And we're becoming healthcare providers with community paramedicine, whatever that might be. And like Chris said, if you've seen one community paramedic school, you've seen one paramedic school, one paramedic program. So I think this is much like the space program. People see the missiles go up and we put somebody in the moon and they think that's all there is. And then they go over and pick up their small, tiny cell phone and make a phone call, not knowing that that came out of it. Or they take their medicines and not knowing that came out of it. Or they warm up whatever they're going to warm up in their microwave and they say, I wonder where that came from. There were tons and tons and tons of things that came out of the space program that we use on an everyday basis. And I kind of mirror the community paramedic program in EMS to that. What is the bad thing, I think, that might have happened, and it's still kind of in development, is in a lot of places the horse is being put before the cart. And what I mean by that, we are jumping out into the community paramedic world to do community paramedic stuff. And oh, by the way, we're going to do a little bit of training. I think people that are involved in the community paramedic program don't need training, but they do need a lot of education. And I'll use a quote from my good friend Don Lee. When people say, well, you know, what's the difference? Well, if you had a 14-year-old daughter, would you rather give her sex education or sex training? Training is a very good way to know what to do and when to do it, steps A, B, and C. Education is really stepping back for a minute and looking at the whole horizon of the issue. And as paramedics go, and I'm a paramedic of 41 years, we don't have a real good education of what happens to the patient in total, what happens to the patient after they get to the hospital, what I need to do to make things better for the hospital besides plugging leaks and calling for surgeons. And I think Minneapolis, I think Minnesota's done a tremendous job of education and some of the other areas. Rob, I think you're one of the places that's done some outstanding education for paramedics in the community paramedic world. There are other places that decide we're going to put a medic in the community and we're going to call it community paramedicine. And I think we need to get a hold of that horse before he breaks out, and we don't know where community paramedic is. I think that's something that we're going to have to deal with over the next 5 to 10 years. But for those listening to this that says, community paramedic, we're never going to do it, it's going to be gone in a couple of years, I don't think so. I think it's here for the long haul, and we're either going to jump on board with that or the train's going to leave without us on it.
Don really got off to an excellent start, but let me just temper some of the sort of wider concepts of community paramedicine for us all for a second. We have a few hundred programs running. That's excellent. We still dine out on the fact that we are making quote unquote system savings of what are astronomical numbers of numbers, which in turn equates to savings to the healthcare system. And whilst this is an excellent way of demonstrating the worth of those one or two individuals that are out there doing community paramedicine on behalf of the entire healthcare system, those cost savings are to someone further down track. And we still haven't managed to work out how we're going to fully fund this. Now, there are programs out there in the country that have managed to get around that. There are some people that are contracting for certain and discrete parts of a service. But as an industry, as a profession, as a nation, we haven't sorted out yet, once and for all, how we're going to fund this formally. And so until we can do that, then it won't really take off. We still have the Part A versus Part B issue. We still have the issue of who's actually acting, as we say here in Richmond, it has to be actuarially sound. In other words, we're not seeking to make a profit from it, but we are seeking to pay someone to do it. We're not there yet, and we still need to work at that. And I know that there are a lot of our national organizations and associations, and we have things like the AAA and also NAMT with their various lobbying activities. We need to keep on this one, because otherwise it will just be a number of pilots doing good things for a few versus a national opportunity to do well for the masses. And the future is very patient-centered. That's what 3.0 is all about. It is about delivering patient-centered care. And the community paramedic is going to be needed in the future, because as this particular strand of our industry, our business, our profession builds, so the population is getting older. We are about to face what someone termed the silver tsunami, we are, the baby boomers are coming to the point now where they're going to become ever more dependent on emergency services, ever more dependent on a community service that's going to keep these people, or going to want to keep these people, in their homes. And so EMS and community paramedicine, mobile integrated healthcare, call it what you will, is an absolute key to part of the solution here, because the tsunami will happen. And this bunch of elderly patients are going to be more discerning, because they are children of, you know, technology. Since, you know, the 1950s, 60s, they've come through, are much more discerning, have much higher expectations. And so we need to be in a position to be able to deliver on that. So there, we're getting there, and it's got a great foundation. But what I'm saying is there's still a long way to go, and we've got to do it on a national level to make sure we get to where we need to be going.
Yeah, and I have to agree with you, and both you guys are really kind of spot on. And, you know, Don, I'm glad that you talked about exactly what 3.1 is, and maybe we should have started off that way by kind of giving the, you know, the differences in what the points were. And, you know, one of the things that we have to be prepared for is that 2018 is going to be a very, very big year, I think, for EMS. And one of the things that CMS has told everyone who's in medicine is that they want to have 90% of the Medicare payments tied to quality-based measures. So when we think about the work that we do, are we doing quality work? And are we able to show that we're doing quality work? I mean, where's the metrics that says what we're doing is actually helping? Where's the metrics that are saying that we're getting people to the hospital and they are, we've made a difference for them on that transport? So, but I think that those are the things we have to start to think about. So when we think about EMS 1.0, that goes back to the white paper days. And that goes back to 1973 when the EMS Systems Act was first, you know, developed. And EMS, the way that it was put together, really kind of started off okay. You know, there was some federal funding, there was a little bit of mandate, and they said, let's go ahead and, get this thing moving along. And then somewhere along the line, that federal money seemed to kind of dry up. And then EMS agencies were told, go ahead and fend for yourself, and you guys figure it out. And that was a big challenge for the career field. And Don, I'm sure you were right in the middle of all that mess when that started happening. And but one of the things that we moved to is kind of the environment that we're in today. And we think about the work that we do. Again, can we put our finger on to say that the everyday work that we're doing is making a difference within our community? Now, you know, we're not talking about the motor vehicle accidents, and we're not talking about the traumas, and we're not talking about those things where, you know, minutes matter. You know, what we're talking about is we're taking people to the hospital that don't necessarily need to go. And even though we're responsible for 1% of the Medicare budget, you know, we're responsible for almost 24% of that downstream revenue. So when we think about EMS 3.0 now, as we move into the future, we need to take the lessons that we learned from the earlier days in the 74s and, you know, the money drying up for the, from the feds and EMS kind of being on its own. Now we're writing the history for the next 50 years, and they're going to look back on us to say, boy, did they really screw the pooch? Or did they really set us up for success? And when we think about 3.0, we really need to think about patient satisfaction. We really need to think about patient outcomes. You know, Don touched on it really well. We need to think about training. You know, so if we think about it, Rob, I'll start with you this time. If we think about the process of developing a program, you know, it's almost now, we've been talking about it since 2009. And, you know, if we start to think about the development, it's almost like we're getting to the 11th hour now, especially if, you know, we've got one more year before, you know, we're going to start to see some changes in our reimbursement. How do we begin this process?
Well, first of all, let's just talk politics for a second, and that by the time this show goes out, you know, in 3 weeks' time, all bets could be off, first of all. I'm not going to predict the outcome of this very peculiar American election that's coming up, but if one party gets it, they could pretty much trash and rubbish the work of the last 8 years. And if the other party gets in, then it'll probably be more of the same. So, that is the first thing we have to watch. The second thing is creating the conditions for the future, whether it's community paramedicine or whether it's the delivery of regular 911 operations. And you touched on it just then, and we're going into value, not volume. And you started to hint at the fact of, well, are we really as an industry, as an individual organizations, able to demonstrate that value we're delivering to the patient right now? Well, the answer is, if it's response times, then I can tell you how fast we drove to get there. Now, arguably within the triple aim, you know, that's could be argued as a measure of patient satisfaction because we were, you know, there on time. But all of those other measures of patient satisfaction that when Patrick was with us and talking, you know, the hospitals do so very, very well with their AHCAPs and Prescaini and all the other good stuff. We've got to get into the business of being measured for satisfaction, and also means we have to deliver patient-centered care that's of quality and is satisfying to the patient. So add that to the to-do list, whether it's community paramedicine or whether it's regular 911 services. That's the first thing we have to get a head around coming up into the future. Delivering, you know, services into the community. I started off back in the UK with a program called ACAPON, Appropriate Care at the Point of Need. That was over 10 years ago, and it was acknowledged as one of the first community paramedic systems around. And part of that was developing those care pathways and those initiatives, not just necessarily healthcare, but mental health care, but social care, a handyman to come and, you know, nail the carpet down and put stair rails on and things. So we need to create those conditions by making sure those partnerships exist, that we are the hub that then extends out into the entire spokes that leads onto the outer rim of the wheel to connect all these things together, because ultimately we're the ones that are dealing with the patient first of all. And so there's a lot of work to do. Now, we need to look at these organizations that are currently doing it. They have cracked it to certain degrees and extents. But as Don and you said, you know, that no one single paramedic community paramedic system is the same as ambulance services. Once you've seen one, you've seen one. Because, you know, in Virginia, they tried to define what is a community paramedic program. And we're like, no, you can't do that yet, because we haven't explored the full extent of what it's going to turn into. And there's so many things that it's turning into right now that, again, we need to define all of this stuff. And then, of course, add the education in order to go forward. So we're very much in our infancy. And, of course, the other thing, I'll go back to what I was talking about, the silver tsunami. And the other thing that we're going to have to get into is not only, you know, hospice revocation and other programs, but in the UK, where the population has demographically peaked, the biggest category of call for 999 911 service is NPDS code 17, which are falls, because you know, folk are becoming increasingly old. They are losing their balance. You know, postmenopausal women are predisposed to fractured neck of femur and osteoporosis, and that's a huge problem over there. And so again, prevention services are going to be key to assist with that falls prevention. We had pickup trucks around the UK as well. So, I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. And yeah, we're at the 11th hour, but we're just going to have to sort of fight the uphill battle for a minute until we can get all of these little pieces of enabling legislation, enabling rules and regulations, and enabling you know, conditions in place in order to go forward. So I'm sort of taking the reverse view to stuff tonight, Chris, because I want to also be very realistic about the challenge we've got ahead of us.
Yeah, I think you bring up some good points. And you know, one of the things that I don't know that could really happen is, you know, we talk about the people are worried about the Affordable Care Act when it comes to maybe a change in politics in November. Man, we're talking about 21 million people that have now become insured. You know, can we really push them to the wayside and say, we're throwing this law out, and you're not going to have health insurance anymore? I mean, I think that there's going to be some variation of this law rather than saying we're going to scrap it and start over. But Don, what do you think from the sense of developing a community paramedicine program at this time? You know, are we at the 11th hour? Does EMS really need to, you know, get on the train before they get hit with it?
I think Rob's exactly right. I think when you look at how long EMS has been discussing community paramedicine, I'll say 6 years, and I bet I'm off by several. But when we first started discussing the program, it was 6 to 8 years ago. 6 to 8 years of discussing it. So, and my hat's off, by the way, to Rob's original hometown over there in the UK. They've been doing this for a number of years, and you know, there haven't been any fistfights or terrible, horrible things that have happened. They've got that going on. So I think in the long run, you know, when we see community paramedic programs springing up, two things come to mind. One, yeah, we are kind of in the 11th hour, because and it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on or what you think of the Affordable Care Act, it really doesn't. What you need to do is look at history at all the government benefits that have been taken away ever and their programs scrapped ever. And I think you'll have the answer to what's going to happen in the future with the Affordable Health Care Act, no matter what you might think of it. Just go ahead and make a list of all the programs that have been scrapped and zeroed out and said, we're not going to do it anymore. And I think you'll have your answer. I want to go back to something you talked about, Chris, for a minute in the very beginning. And this, I think this is key to a community paramedic program. And it's kind of in the background. And it doesn't exactly have to do with the medics who are doing this medicine. And yet it does. You're right. In 1973, they wrote this white paper. And based upon the information they had, the ambulance service, because it wasn't called EMS, the ambulance services were created, the regulatory side of it was created to take care of traffic accidents. That's why it was under the Department of Transportation. Let's see, transportation cars on the road, big crashes. Okay, let's do that. The idea that we were going to take care of heart attacks and strokes and medical issues, that's just crazy. You're going to go out and pick up people from car crashes. And I think that set the stage for us being technicians on a truck that took people to the hospital no matter what, because, you know, of course, now we're talking way back in 1973, we certainly didn't have the education or the experience to decide who did and did not need to go. And there wasn't anywhere else to go. There weren't standalone ERs. There weren't doctors open after 5. There were docs that made house calls still then. But the idea that you had this plethora of medical care out there, you either went to the ER or you didn't go, or you made an appointment for your doc. So we were not part of the medical community when the ambulance service was created and it became emergency medical services. And, you know, any of the, and I'll use the term, any of the old timers that are out there, and I think all three of us are probably relatively in the, although we're all young at heart, the old timers that look at the technical aspect and the medical aspect and how we've advanced, it's been awesome. I mean, just the change from my mother who spent 3 weeks in a hospital with a heparin drip while they stared at her and hoped that something good happened. That's how he did heart attack. I think we need to be part of the medical community instead of the technician that takes somebody to the hospital. And that's going to be a tall order for a lot of places in this country. It has to happen, I think, for a community paramedicine program to exist and to flourish. And that will be hard for the physicians and nurses and facilities and for the EMS systems, because that's not easy. It's hard. It's supposed to be hard or everybody would do it. So I think that's a big step we need to take when we're developing these. And being, as Rob said, in the 11th hour, that's a tall order. But we've got to take the step of stop being technicians and being medical professionals, part of the team, part of... Nurses aren't the enemy. Doctors aren't the enemy. We aren't the enemy. It's the sick guy there in the bed that we need to take care of. And if we need to be part of that medical community, I think. And I think that's missing within some community paramedic programs. I'd say the majority. Now, there's probably a small group that has integrated those people into the medical system. And that's hard work. That means people need to sit down at the table and not get mad at one another and look each other in the eye and say, what can I do to help you, and what can I do to fill in this gap? We're making strides, tremendous strides in this program, but there's got to be more.
Yeah, and I think that really brings up the thought of how are we going to meet this transition in this new healthcare environment, and we've kind of been left alone. And one of the reasons that we're trying to, you know, kind of bring the career field forward is the writing's on the wall, and we're trying to, you know, change the way that we do things before it's mandated of, you know, how much money we're going to get reimbursed or, you know, what we're supposed to be doing. And hopefully we're doing the right things here. So this will be my last question, guys, and I'll start with Rob. If people want to start developing a community paramedicine program, Rob, do you have any advice for them as the best way to get started?
I think the first thing is you need to do some sort of community needs assessment, both from the population at risk in general and also canvass the local hospitals as to what their significant issues are. And actually one way of doing that is to look at CMS or look at Kaiser and see what they're getting, dare I say, getting dinged for right now, because they are, and you know, most hospitals are getting fined for something or the other, and that's almost the sort of entry discussion you can have with them. So it's data, but it's actually intelligence. It's taking the information, assessing it, collating it, collecting it and collating it, and developing an intelligence product to help you go forward, because you need to know which part of your system and your service area needs what and how do they need it. It will help you then develop a business plan for how to go forward. Also, again, coming from Virginia, you need to look at to see what the political situation is, what the legislative situation is. There may be some quirky rules that may either assist you or may actually slow you down a little bit. So again, you need to understand what the situation is. Some states now, for example, Denver, Washington, I think, Arkansas have actually now published community paramedic legislation, and so that's great. But again, look and see what the theme and the feel of your state is in order to work out if you're into a permissive environment. Double check with your Office of EMS as well. So lots of background work to do. To Don's point as well, we certainly learnt this back in the east of England and in my old days in East Anglian Ambulance, that a paramedic does not a community paramedic make, because what we discovered is a lot of these things are primary care based. Whilst we're good at the traumatic end of medicine, there may be further instruction and classes that you need to take in order to prepare your workforce to go out there and to deal effectively. So there's an education and training and education component, call it, pick whichever one you want to. So again, those and there are classes and there are things now in place that you can go through to set yourself up. So legislation, education, permissive environment, and from there then you can start to reach out and to go forward. But I think where systems are failing, and actually down at Pinnacle, we, Matt Zabadsky, Doug Hooten, myself and a few others, Neil Richmond, did a class simply called Why Community Paramedicine is Failing. And there are some systems that are already getting to the point of frustration and perhaps failure, because the underpinning effort hasn't been in place. So just to think, I can get a car, I can get a magnet that says community paramedicine, I can slap it on the side and go out and do good in the community, may look good, but it won't reap the results, I think, that you we can all achieve with that application of good first principles.
I liked it. That was really well said. Don, what do you think? What advice for the people out there that are looking at?
I got to tell you, I'm absolutely speechless, Rob. You hit it right on the head about what is needed. I think so many people are excited about this happening, and they want to go out and do stuff without going to, and I'll just say, you could go to one emergency room and say, tell me what your top five return patients are. Tell me there's a need I can fill. I don't want to do home health care. That's not what we're doing. But where can I fill a need? And more often than not, you'll get a ton of data and several people standing up saying, gosh, you know, we never even thought about, or we did think about it, but we didn't think you were thinking about it. And right in line with that at the same time, somebody needs to be at your state legislature, either to take their own representative, and that's what I would recommend. I love the state officials. They do some great work, but I would not go to a regulator and say, we've got to think about the regulations for community paramedicine. I'm not sure that's the best way to go initially until you find out what politics is involved. Rob's exactly right. If you work with the regulators for, and I'm talking, this is a 1 to 2 to 3 year work. That's my opinion, Rob. You might think different, but I think this is about a 3 year haul to get some regulations that are ready to go before the legislature. And for whatever reason, the legislature is not interested. You've just spent 3 years twiddling your thumbs. You need to look at both of those at the same time. And you don't need, in my opinion, again, you don't need to look and say, what can we do to make a community paramedic program? That's way out in front. But what can you do to help gaps in the system? There are gaps in the system. We know there are. What can I do? And if you get that strange look of, gee, I don't have any idea, that's when you go, well, let me tell you about Virginia. Let me tell you about Denver. Let me tell you about Austin, and give start the seeds there within the legislative process. So when the regulators have regulations to go, or more likely when the legislature turns to the regulatory agency and say, work with the state EMS system and see a state EMS association and see what you can do. All that background talking over coffee stuff will have gotten a tremendous amount of movement. But Rob's exactly right. This is not an 80 hour sit and learn and go do program. And it has much more benefits, long-term benefits for the survivability of emergency medical services. And the minute I hear somebody say, well, you know, we're never going away, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of entities that said they're never going to go away that have. There's a couple of coal miners up in the Pennsylvania country. They said they're never going away. We'll always need coal. We'll always need oil. I think that would disagree with you somewhat on the horizon that's out there. So always have an open mind. Always be ready to get knocked back on your heels a time or two. We're used to that as paramedics. We go and work on a patient and something happens bad, and we simply, you know, retool and recad and take it on again. So this is a long-term issue that I promise you, within 3 to 4 to 5 years, you're going to look back and say, boy, I was glad we got on that train, because there's three ways to do this. You either don't get on the train and it leaves the station without you. You will not want to be there in the station. You get on the train and you say, what's next? Or you stand in front of the train and it's going to run you over. Those are the three places where you can be. And it's a very exciting 3.0 is going to stretch out over a wide berth of different areas of EMS, all of which we as professionals complain about that somebody's not doing enough about. We're going to get to write this history, and we're going to get to change it. Or we can just sit in the station and watch the train go by. I don't want to be sitting in the station.
And it's definitely, I got to agree with you guys, it's definitely going to be an interesting time. And for, you know, those of you out there, you know, get on the train. And I don't think you'll be disappointed in that. But guys, I got to tell you, I want to thank you so much. The first one back, you made it easy. We had a great little discussion. I think next time we're going to talk about employee engagement and how we can now think about the workforce of tomorrow. So everybody out there, go ahead and join us and, you know, see if we can pick up some tips on how to engage your workforce as we start to talk about, you know, how important our workforce is to the organizational success. But Rob, Don, I want to thank you for the first one back. And I guess we'll see you guys in a couple weeks.
Absolutely.
It's good to be back, Chris.
And for everybody out there, you know, I got to tell you, we took a little bit of break and we missed you guys. We talked about it constantly of trying to get back to in front of the microphone and bringing you some great leadership content. Let's get back to the days of sending those emails and giving us suggestions for the shows, letting us know what you think about the shows. And this is Chris Sabalero. Until next time, thank you for joining us on the EMS Leadership Podcast.